the Swami and again made his base in India. He has since traveled widely throughout the subcontinent, lecturing in English, Hindi and Bengali. His Holiness also travels to and preaches Krishna consciousness in other parts of the world. He continues to write books and magazine articles. His books have been translated into more than 15 languages. And today His Holiness came all the way from San Diego for one day to be with us and to give us the nectar of devotional service and Krishna consciousness. Thank you so much. Thank you Maharaj for that coming.
So we're going to have 5 minutes, kirtan, spiritual sound. Get the cartels. Yeah, we'll begin, I'm going to hold that. We'll begin with 5 minutes of kirtan. Who has heard the word kirtan? Does anyone know what kirtan means? It's becoming quite popular in America now. It's certainly well known in India. Those of you who are from India, which seems like most of the group, you all certainly know what the word kirtan means. Well, maybe the best thing is just to do it, and then you can see. It's a participatory activity. It's becoming popular in America for relieving stress, calming the mind, focusing the mind. Although, as I will discuss in the presentation, this the highest yoga, controlling the mind, is only a beginning, actually. There's a higher spiritual aim. Anyway, we'll do kirtan, which is singing mantras in a responsive manner. I'll sing, and you can all follow. Do we have the mantra printed out? Okay. Pass this sheet. Everyone has it, yeah. The mantra is one of the most popular kirtan mantras in America and all over the world now. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I'll sing, and we request you to join with this. Join us in singing. I'll sing, and then you all sing together. So, you hold this.
And can we request everyone to please change your cell phones to vibration mode or switch it off, please? Thank you so much.
That's very good. Thank you. We have to sing a little quietly because we don't want to disturb the class. Yeah, but. So thank you very much for coming this evening for this lecture titled The Yoga of Mind Control, subtitled A Vedic Perspective. Vedic is an English word derived from the Sanskrit word Veda, which means knowledge. This is not a sectarian term, because knowledge is knowledge everywhere. Just like 2 plus 2 equals 4 in America, in Canada, in Russia, everywhere. The principle applies everywhere. So this is generally considered an Indian system, but actually it's a system which applies to everyone, everywhere, in all times. If it's actually knowledge, it must apply in all times, all places, and all circumstances. So there'll be some technical terms, but although these are in Sanskrit, they will be, I'll translate them into English, and you can derive the benefit from that. Now the word, another Sanskrit word which has very much entered the English language is the word yoga, which is a very much misunderstood word. Well, let's ask, what do you understand by yoga? Everyone's heard the word yoga. What's your name? Sorry, you're up from Ohio, San Diego?
Oh, yeah, I live here. But,
yeah.
It's, I think people derive it more as exercise, where it's, I'm guessing it's more mindfulness, concentration.
Exercise with some idea of mental function and concentration. Well, that's good. Most people think it's just exercise. That's a good step up. Anyone else?
It's meditation.
Yoga is connected with meditation, yeah. Yoga Indriya Sanyamya. This is in the original texts, it's stated that yoga is meant for control of what? The mind of the senses. Yoga is meant for control of the senses. And in the Vedic psychology system, the mind is considered the center of the senses. So yoga is really about mind control. When we say the yoga of mind control, I was told that some students, when they were being handed the pamphlets, they were asking, why yoga and mind control? But actually yoga is all about mind control, and the exercises, which are very popular in the West at the present time, they're quite effective if followed properly, that is only meant to be a precursor to the art of mind control. And the mind control is meant for something else. It's a step-by-step process. So why mind control? Why should we be interested in mind control? Well, if the mind is controlled, one can achieve great things. And if the mind is not controlled, then we can't achieve anything. If the mind is not controlled, we can completely wreck our lives. And that happens to many people. What do alcoholics, compulsive gamblers, repeated criminals, what do they all have in common? They didn't control their mind. They can't control their mind. They feel, maybe someone says, from tomorrow, I'm never going to smoke again. And then they get up in the morning and they just think, wow, okay, I'll just take one more. And that's it, they're off again. Can't control the mind. The mind is the center of the senses. The senses are seeing, touching, feeling, smelling, tasting. And as you are saying, it's very difficult to control the mind, especially in Los Angeles, because everywhere, wherever we are in the world, all the time, there are sensual stimulations. But particularly in Los Angeles or any materialistic city, the whole emphasis of society, the whole emphasis of the culture is to keep our senses constantly stimulated by taste. We should always drink something, eat something, smoke something. Visually, there's billboards everywhere, there's TVs you can watch, cinema you can watch, internet, there are so many things. The touch sense is consummated in sexual acts, which is, there's a lot of stimulation for that. And then all kinds of foods. In Los Angeles, you can get all kinds of foods, styles from all over the world, and there are advertisements all the time for stimulate, all the time, stimulate the senses, stimulate the stim. So all the time, the mind is getting pulled here and there. An example is given in the Vedic literature of the mind is just like, supposed to be the driver of a chariot which has got five horses, which are the ear, eyes, nose, skin, tongue, yeah, for tasting. So if all of the horses are controlled by the driver who knows where he's going, then it goes very nicely. But if the horses are out of control and they're all pulling this way and that way and the other way, you can have an accident. So the driver has to be strong, he has to know his art, and he has to control the senses so that the senses benefit the driver and not that they just simply pull him here and there. So some level of mental control has to be there for every human being. Otherwise, if it's not there, then we say that if a human being at the age of 20 acts the same way he does at the age of 2, then we say that he's mentally retarded. They may have some other term nowadays, but he never really developed. There has to be some mental control. A child doesn't have any mental control, but gradually, as he grows up, there's trained in that, and then automatically, with the development of the body, the mind also matures and develops. And then you go to school and get disciplined. And one has to learn self-discipline also, isn't it? It has to be self-discipline. A baby has no self-discipline. If he feels hungry, he screams. If you feel hungry, you don't scream. But you know what to do, so you do what is required to fulfill the demand of the sense. So to some extent, the mind is under control. And to the extent that the mind is under control, one is considered a balanced person. But actually, everyone's mind is flickering all the time. In the Vedic terms, there are two functions that the mind has two functions which it operates on off, constantly. These are called sankalpa and vikalpa, which in this context means accepting and rejecting. Just like we see something, I want that. Or, I don't want that. I want that, but then we calculate, but I can't get it without, it's too much trouble to get it, okay, forget it. These are the functions of the mind, constantly, at every moment. If a clown comes in here and starts quacking like a duck, then all our attention will go over there, because it's instantly more interesting than this presentation. Immediately, I've seen it many times in lectures, that even something happens, it's a mind, someone just walks from one side of the room to the other, and immediately people's attention is distracted, even though it's of no importance to anyone. But just the tendency for the mind to get distracted is so strong. On the other hand, if someone is completely absorbed in doing something, then he may not be distracted, even if there's a great cause for distraction. There's an example given, you don't see that, I suppose, in America, but still in what are called third world countries, you may find a cobbler sitting on the side of the road. All of those who are from India have seen this. There's a cobbler sitting on the side of the road mending people's shoes. So the example is given that if he's completely absorbed in making or mending shoes, then the king may go past. And if the king goes past, it doesn't mean he's just out for a stroll. It means there's a whole big cavalcade, just like the president goes in his car, and there'll be police on motorcycles, and there'll be police cars, and there'll be sirens, and it'll be a whole big show. But if someone's absorbed in something else, he doesn't even notice it. So that kind of absorption means he's absorbed in his work, he's doing a very good job. He wants to do a very good job, and he's so much absorbed, he doesn't even notice anything else. So there is sankalpa and vikalpa, accepting and rejecting, and how to rise above the platform of accepting and rejecting, just every moment. This, that. The light goes on, the light goes off. We hear something, there's a sound in the background. There's a sound in the background? Can you all hear that? It sounds like a fan or something. You don't notice it. If we point it out, you can notice it. If it's turned off, then we'll notice it. The sound's no longer there. So all the time, the stimuli are coming. How to control this? Well, there's no harm in the stimuli coming, but how to, the real question is how to process it in a manner that is most beneficial. Again, in the Sanskrit language, there are two terms. One is Shreyas, and one is Prayas. Shreyas means that which is immediately beneficial, or that appears to be immediately beneficial, and Prayas means that which is long-term beneficial. So, I think you're all students, is it? You're all students here? So you're all engaged in Prayas. In other words, if you had the choice, what you'd really like to do, you'd maybe like to go to sleep, take a rest, or go to a party, or go for a swim. But no, you're studying. Why is that? Is it a lot of fun studying? They say it is in the prospectuses, but actually it's a lot of hard work, isn't it? But you're doing it, why? Because you have the conviction that by doing so, you will have a better future. So you're putting off the immediate benefit that you could have by doing a billion other things that you could imagine doing for the sake of pursuing a course which will give you a longer term benefit. So here is where the mind interfaces with the intelligence. That just like someone said, okay, someone's a little chubby, overweight, not like this body which I happen to be in at the moment, and someone brings a big slice of cream cake, delicious, but the doctor told me, no, you have to cut down on your calories. So I'd love to eat it, but it's going to give me more problems, health problems, so no, I'm not going to eat it. That is an instance of mind control, considering what is my long-term benefit over my immediate benefit. So in this way, the setting up the principles, what do we want in life, what do we need in life, what is actually going to be the best for me, that should be fixed in mind and sticking to that. Now, how to get the determination to stick to that? And that's one question. Another question is to understand what actually is for our long, what is our best benefit? Now, in Bhagavad Gita, which those of you from India at least have heard of, it's a book of yoga. Karma yoga, which means the yoga of action. Jnana yoga, which means the action of the yoga of knowledge. Dhyana yoga, which means the yoga of meditation. And ultimately, bhakti yoga, which means the yoga of devotion, is the way the term bhakti is usually translated. Now, in the sixth chapter, there's a long discussion. Krishna, who's the speaker of Bhagavad Gita, gives a long talk to Arjuna, who's the hearer, about this yoga of meditation, which is based on mind control. See what I said? Someone comes in, it's of no importance, it's got nothing to do with it, immediately everyone's attention goes away. Just see how fickle their mind is. Thank you. You demonstrated a point I made, the fickleness of the mind. I'm just going to come to that right now. We don't have enough seats. There's one here, and there's one here. I don't need this seat. You can take it. So please come and take a seat, and I'll stand up. And there's another seat here. All right, there's another seat there. So there's a long description of the traditional system of meditation, which some semblance of that is popular in the Western world at the present time. But the basic principles they don't follow, so there's actually what's going on in the name of meditation, not only in the West, but in India also. There's 15 minutes meditation in the morning, and it doesn't work. The point of meditation, first of all, is to steady the mind. But the way it's done in the modern age, it's just not going to work because it's such an intense system. What is required to control the mind by that system is so demanding and practically impossible in the modern age that meditation, as described in Bhagavad Gita, it's practically impossible in the modern age. Because the first thing that's required is to go to a sacred place. Los Angeles? Well, it's not that sacred, is it? So then one has to learn how to sit properly, withdraw the mind from the senses. Remember, we're talking about how there's always constant titillation of the senses. So generally this meditation will be practiced after one has learned how to sit properly with a straight back, which most people can't do in the modern age. Then one has to learn how to breathe properly, which no one knows how to do either. Then the mind automatically becomes somewhat peaceful, and that's where the exercises come in. All these exercises, yoga asanas, that's simply meant to prepare the mind to become somewhat peaceful. That's all it's meant for, actually. So, when the mind becomes somewhat peaceful, then one can start to effectively withdraw it from the sense objects, and the meditation is on the object of the self within. Atma, that's the term used. One should meditate on the self within. Now, interestingly, this discussion of meditation was spoken on a battlefield, which is just about the opposite from what you might think the proper venue for a discourse on yoga. Well, that was the whole point which Krishna wanted to make to Arjuna, because Arjuna, he wanted to leave the battlefield. He said, I don't want to fight. This fight is not just. He wasn't against the principle of fighting per se, but in this instance, I should not fight. But Krishna convinced him that he would perform yoga better by fighting than by not fighting. Now that's a very big discussion which I won't get into here. But the point that Arjuna had proposed to leave everything, and then he was planning to go away and just become renounced from the world and be a yogi. And then Krishna explained to him what it means to be a yogi, and Arjuna said, hey, wait a minute, that sounds too difficult. Arjuna said, it might be possible to control the mind, but it seems to me easier to control the raging wind. Is it possible to control the wind? Obviously not. So Lord Krishna said, yes, it's true that it's very, very difficult to control the mind, but it is possible. And there are two principles that he gave. One is practice, and the other is detachment. So practice means that one has, over a long period of time, one has to practice performing all these yoga activities, and one has to simultaneously be detached from this world. Now, this is another great secret, actually, of yoga or any science or becoming a billionaire or whatever. This is the art that Krishna taught to Arjuna. Yoga karma kosalam. Yoga karma su kosalam. The art of working in yoga means that one should simultaneously pursue the goal with great determination and at the same time be detached. Now, how is that possible? You want to achieve something, but at the same time you're detached. So Lord Krishna explains that we should try hard. That is our duty, to try hard to do the best in whatever line we're doing. But at the same time, we understand that we are not the controller. someone works very hard, someone is very intelligent, they're very well-meaning, but they don't get anywhere. Actually, of course, if someone does try like that, then as it said, man proposes and God disposes. That if you persist long enough, then generally God will help you. God, well, we'll come to that later. So, but it may be that someone else, even without trying, they achieve some result which someone else has tried for very hard. Please come inside. Seemingly effortlessly. Yeah, please come inside. Actually, many of the great scientific discoveries, they have come in the eureka moment. That someone is thinking about a problem and they can't solve it and they're trying this much and that, and when they completely forget it, they're in their bath. They're lying in the bathtub and forgetting all, relaxing, all of a sudden, eureka. They get the solution. So a sense of detachment that I am not the controller. I can try hard. I should try my best, but ultimately the result is not in my hands. I'm a very tiny, everyone should understand this, a great secret of life. To understand that although I think I'm the most important person, and to me, I may be the most important person. Everyone generally thinks. You may hear the news that 10,000 people die in an earthquake, but generally we on the other side of the world, but if I stub my toe, I think that's much worse. Oh, I got this pain in my toe. And 10,000, yeah, 10,000 people died. And I was going, okay, what else? What's the sports news? We tend to see ourselves as the most important person, but everyone should understand we are very tiny living beings in a very great universe. We live for, at least in this life, for a very short time. So, we needn't take ourselves so seriously. Then why are we doing this discussion about mind control? Why not just have a party and don't try to do anything? Just hang out and have fun. So that comes to the next point. For what? Shreyas and prayas. Immediate gain and ultimate gain. Then what is the ultimate gain? What is the purpose of what we're doing? Just like you're studying so you can have a better future. What's this college all about? What's everyone studying mostly? It's all different subjects. So.
Engineering.
You're studying engineering. Well, that's a wide field in itself. There's some financial discussion going. It's mostly a night college, is it? So, you're all on tight schedules. Schedules. You're working in the day, is it? And studying at night. So you're all serious people. You want to get ahead. You want to do the best in life, isn't it? So in Bhagavad Gita, this is after all a Vedic perspective, from the perspective of Vedic knowledge, then the question comes up, then what is the ultimate goal? What is it ultimately that we're doing? Arjuna, he wanted to do the best thing possible. He'd always been a very dutiful person. And he had fought many battles. He was trained as a fighter. And he had fought many times. And he wasn't worried about having fought many times because he was concerned with righteousness, dharma. So he only fought for the right cause. Now fighting, that's something that requires a lot of concentration, right? There's no time to just kind of, you know, do-do-do-do-do in the middle of a battle when people are shooting arrows at you. You have to be intensely focused all the time. And talking about titillations coming to the senses, I mean, arrows are coming at you on all sides. It requires intense concentration and intense training before you even go out there. No one should be even allowed to go on a battlefield unless they are intensely trained. But of course, we are all on the battlefield of life, and all the time the titillations that are coming at us, they are just like arrows which are entering our consciousness and disturbing it from the ultimate goal of life. So that we tend to think that what I am doing is so important. I have to get a lot of money, get prestige, get position, get a big house, get a big car, all these different things, without understanding that, why do I consider myself so important? What's so important about me? I must be somewhat important to even think myself, but why does everyone think they're important? When if we examine, we're not important. If we examine, we're a tiny little being living for a tiny blip of time on a tiny little part of a tiny planet, which is itself a speck in a massive universe, then why do we take ourselves so seriously? Well, we are important. That's why every living being has this intrinsic, inherent feeling that I am important. But why are we important? It's not because of this blip in time existence that we have, but we are eternally existent. So the real goal, what are we going to control our mind for? That should be considered. I can become a great artist, I can become a great scientist, I can become a great scholar, I can become a great baseball player. But what is that which will ultimately satisfy us? Because unless we're ultimately satisfied, we can control our mind to perform some particular function. But if that function doesn't, if we actually attain the goal that we're aiming for, but it doesn't satisfy us, then what was the point anyway? Then again we have to go on and try for another goal, or become totally disappointed. So it's essential in the beginning to consider the question, what are we doing, why are we doing, what is our ultimate goal in life? Then we have to consider, what is life? What is the mind anyway? What is the mind? The mind is the mental functions, they are functions of consciousness. What is consciousness? Now, there is in the last 15 years or so, there's a discipline, interdisciplinary study of consciousness has come up in universities. Prior to that, it came up, so I'm told, I'm not a scientist, but it's come up as a result of the need of study of consciousness in quantum physics, because the role of the observer is that's becomes part of the whole system of quantum physics. So what is the role of, what is consciousness? Now, previously it had been considered, at least in mechanistic science, that consciousness is simply a result of the organic combination that is our bodies. When different chemicals come together in a certain way in various bodies, then consciousness is produced. But there's no evidence for that, and there's no way that anyone can blend chemicals to create a conscious being. So the study of consciousness necessarily comes into philosophy and metaphysics. The Vedic version is that consciousness is the symptom of life, and that life is a different kind of entity, a different phenomena altogether from that of matter. And thus that matter, at any stage of combination, doesn't in and of itself give rise to life, although life, living being, or in Atma in Sanskrit, or soul in English, that can enter various vessels or various bodies. which are said to be alive, but it's only alive because the soul is within it. The life doesn't come from the chemicals, the life comes from the soul. That's why we say when someone dies, he or she has gone away, but the body is still there. Isn't it? In any language of the world, when someone dies, they say he's gone away. That means that we all intrinsically know, intuitively, we know that the body and the person are something different. So considering the nature of who we are as persons, we are important because we are actually eternal living beings. And this sankalpa, vikalpa, accepting, rejecting, we're always accepting something and rejecting something because ultimately we desire happiness. We all desire to be happy. So how to find ultimate happiness? This should be the intelligent question. What is ultimately going to make me happy? I'll be happy if I get an Olympic gold medal. I will be happy if I could find $800 billion or so and throw it into the treasury pocket so the taxpayers can be saved. I will be happy if I can make a new scientific discovery. Or less ambitious, I will be happy if I can live a fairly decent life and have a fairly decent career and a fairly decent family life or whatever. So these may be our aims and objectives. But considering on the platform of eternity, that I am an eternal living being. After death, after the death of the body, I continue to exist. Therefore, we should perform the yoga of work, of living within this world with our mind control. That means acting on two levels. Within this world, we do our duty, whatever that may be, it's different for each person, as well as we can. But at the same time, understand that whatever I do, everything here will be finished. Even if I'm a great leader, eventually my name, even the name of George Bush, which is well known all over the world now, there will be a time when that name, even the name will be forgotten. That will, in course of time. So, what is the acting in this world, doing our duty as best as we can? Doesn't mean that one shouldn't have any material ambition, but at the same time understanding that my highest aim is a spiritual aim. I am ultimately a spiritual living being, and the mind, as long as it's interacting on this material level, trying to accept things for material enjoyment or avoiding those things which may give me distress, as long as I'm simply on this level, it's actually the animal level. The animals are doing the same. So the human level, that begins with the intellectual level, that's above the sensual level, and beyond that is the understanding of the soul. So we propose to you, you can take this just like yoga is taken for bodily health. So you can take it like that. Or you can come to the yoga of mind control, understand these principles of mind control and apply them in our lives. They're not very difficult principles to understand. And we can have mental control also. They're not difficult principles to understand. They are difficult. They may be difficult to practice, just like Arjuna said. It's difficult to control the mind. It's more difficult than controlling the wind. So, but with determination and understanding, fixing our intelligence on a higher goal, I want to have a better job than I have now, so I'm coming to night school and I'm studying and I'm going to do it. I don't like studying this, but I'm going to do it because in future I'm going to have a better future. Okay, so this kind of mental control is there. So that can be applied in all areas of our life. Consciously thinking, What are my goals? Is this conducive to this or is it not? What do I want? What do I need out of life? And acting, always keeping the goals in mind. These are basic principles. But then, even above and beyond this, one can achieve the highest level of mental control and achieve the highest goal of life by understanding our eternal spiritual nature. And while living in this world and acting in this world, performing our material duties, simultaneously cultivating knowledge of our spiritual nature and performing spiritual yoga, which leads the mind or to a higher level of consciousness. There are various levels of consciousness. On a very low level of consciousness, one only thinks of one's own immediate self-interest. If it's good for me, good. And to hell with everyone else. And then we start to realize, well, if I do that, then everyone will say to me, to hell with you too. And so we start to interact with others in a more considerate way, but actually it's all self-motivated because we're thinking, just like how to win friends and influence people. Be nice to others so that you can take advantage of them later. Or so that you can get benefit from them. The highest platform is one of complete selflessness. In this platform, one is completely self-fulfilled. Because as long as we're thinking, what's in it for me, we can never be fully satisfied. That's why we find that, oh well, Mother Teresa, for instance, has been highly lauded in recent times as a selfless person. So people recognize this selflessness is a higher level of consciousness. But to ultimately understand our position in the whole cosmic setup, that there is this supreme consciousness who is Krishna. Again, this may sound sectarian, but it requires more investigation on your part to understand this, that we're talking of what is called Veda or knowledge, and that our self-interest is best served by yoga, which means yoga ultimately means linking. Yoga means to yoke. There's an old English word, yoke, to join our consciousness with the supreme consciousness, which is by nature Sat Chit Ananda, eternal, full of bliss, and full of divine knowledge. So one can control the mind to oppress others also. One can control the mind for bad purposes. One can control the mind for materially good purposes, for materially fruitful purposes, or one can control the mind to come to the highest level of consciousness, which we call Krishna consciousness. That is effected by bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga means the yoga of devotion, and that includes the karma yoga, the yoga of work, and Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge. As far as this meditational process is concerned, I was saying the way it's going on in the modern world, it's practically a farce, if we know what the original system is, and is not even recommended for the modern age in the Vedic literature. That was recommended for an age long ago, when society was much more peaceful and calm, and the whole culture was not like Los Angeles. But in the modern age, the bhakti yoga process is recommended, which includes chanting, a purification of our existence by taking, just like we're now going to offer everyone, a complimentary vegetarian meal. Not just vegetarian, but it's offered to Krishna, it's sanctified food. So all these activities, Krishna-focused activities, this purifies the consciousness. And then the process of purifies the consciousness, and we we begin to experience divine happiness. And when we get the experience of that, then it becomes very easy accepting and rejecting. Instead of accepting and rejecting, what do I want this, do I want that, when we start to experience the divine happiness of Krishna consciousness, then naturally we want to act in Krishna consciousness more and more and more. And we like to take this food offered to Krishna called Krishna prasada, and we don't want to take other things. So it's a natural, it's a very natural and easy process which everyone can take up in their lives, can add it to our lives. As you can probably guess, I'm a monk, so this is my life full time. But there are many others in Krishna consciousness who are not monks, lay people, we can say, students, engineers. What are you doing? You're some kind of an engineer, doing something with cell phones. All kinds of occupations, but that means that just like Arjuna was doing, he's doing his worldly occupation and at the same time focusing his consciousness on Krishna, in Krishna consciousness. And he took up the challenge from Krishna, not to run away and renounce the world, but to perform his duty, even though it seemed like it was the wrong thing to do. But Krishna, of course, that's quite a complex discussion, understanding what was right and wrong in a very complex circumstance. But Arjuna did that, and he, by doing so, achieved the perfection of life, pure spiritual consciousness, by fighting. We don't have to fight, but we have to live in this world. It's not easy. But by concentrating on our goal, especially if we make that as a spiritual goal, then we also get help from this. The help comes down. That comes down anyway for everyone, but especially that help comes down for the higher level, from the higher level, for those who are trying to go up to it. So I'll finish this little talk here, and if there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to give, please go ahead right now. If you want, you can write it down on a piece of paper and pass it up also. Well, either you're all completely convinced, or you thought that everything I said was completely rubbish, or you didn't understand anything at all.
Are you going to be taking us through some exercises to meditate?
Well, we had at the beginning, that's actually the best process that's recommended in the Vedic literatures for this age. The yoga of devotion, especially based on singing the mantra, the mantra, Hare Krishna mantra. And actually it does a lot more than simply, as I was saying, in America it's becoming very popular now, this kirtan, or singing mantras, for stress relief, calming the mind, concentrating the mind. But that's only really, there's a lot more to it than that. But yeah, we can do that. Yeah, we'll do that again. How's the session next door? We didn't want to do it very loudly last time. We didn't want to disturb that. There's also, apart from this group singing, which, like I say, it's becoming quite popular in America now, there's individual mantra meditation, which everyone can do at home or wherever you are, chanting on beads. Oops. This is usually done early in the morning, before dawn. And one generally sitting down quietly and fingering the beads, and repeating the mantra over and over again quietly, just for oneself to hear. That's been and is, up to the present day, one of the prime processes of meditation in India, which, like I say, it's at least the singing part is catching on now in America. There are two ways: singing in a group and chanting silently by oneself or in a meditation group.
Where does Hare Krishna fall between Buddhism, Hindu, and Muslim?
Well, like I said, it's 2 plus 2 is knowledge is knowledge everywhere. So we may put some designation. We like to put things in boxes, and then we think we've understood it. But just like we say, 2 plus 2, that equals 4. That comes in arithmetic. That's a name we put on it. But the actually 2 plus 2 plus 4 is a very philosophical statement. It's because what is 2? It's an abstraction, isn't it? It's a concept. Numbers are that's a whole branch of philosophy. Do numbers actually exist or not? But the principle 2 plus 2 equals 4, that can be used in all branches of mathematics, and we say this in geometries and trigonometry and calculus, different things. But it actually the principle transcends the name that we put on it to help us understand it. So generally the name put on this to understand it is Hinduism. But it's actually a very inadequate term, because this knowledge or this process was there long before the word Hindu was there. Hindu is a relatively modern word which came up approximately the time of the first Muslim invasions of India, because it was Muslim invaders gave the name Hindu to the people who lived on the other side of the Sindhu River. So we won't find it in the Vedic literature. So yeah, culturally we can say, or for the sake of putting a label, we can say Hindu. But it's to understand the profundity of it requires going just beyond a label.
Krishna was a human, or was a deity?
Again, deity is a better term.
Okay.
Yeah. Although, again, to understand what is the meaning of that, it requires more philosophical investigation. Krishna, in the words of our spiritual master, he used the English term. There are various terms used in Sanskrit. Bhagavan, which means who possesses all opulences in full. It's a more complete definition than the word God. It means that person who has all wealth, fame, strength, knowledge, and renunciation, who possesses all opulences in full, is called Bhagavan. So that term is used for Krishna. And he appears in this world apparently as a human, but not a human. He's always, as you said, the deity. That's a good term. And he speaks Bhagavad Gita, which is a treatise on, it's very short, it's only 700 verses, but it's a treatise on yoga, on various systems of, not all stages of yoga can even be considered fully spiritual, but they all lead to the spiritual. And in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna teaches Arjuna, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, the yoga of action, knowledge, meditation, and ultimately bhakti. And he says that bhakti or devotion, that is the highest yoga, and that is executed with knowledge and with action. So often people think, well, either you work, or you cultivate knowledge, or you do devotion. But Krishna explained that devotion, that subsumes knowledge and action. So if one's mind is fixed on Krishna, then one can do everything in this world apparently like someone else, like anyone else. Generally a devotee will do things in a very responsible way, because he sees everything in the world is coming from Krishna, is Krishna's. So we should treat this world properly, and whatever duties have been given by him, we have to do them in a responsible manner. But at the same time, his consciousness is fixed in a higher plane. That's called yoga karmasu kaushalam, the art of performing work in this world as yoga. It's a very, like I say, yoga nowadays, people think it's something just for exercise, but it's actually very, very deep subject, which is traditionally was taught in ashrams, which are withdrawn from the hubbub, the bustle of life, in which it's just concentrating on that alone for several years. So we have modernized versions. And but the principles can be, the basic principles can be applied. And as I was saying, this is Ved means knowledge, so we find there are many gurus, for one, and here I'm talking about people who are talking about personality development, and they often talk about the same kind of things because these are universally applicable principles. So start with the goal in mind. That's one of Stephen Covey's seven habits. So it's something he's discovered by thinking about it. It's a universally applicable principle, which intelligent people in all cultures and all times and places and circumstances can identify and work according to. Lord Krishna summarized it all in Bhagavad Gita, but he gave an idea of actually what the highest goal should be. That's the difference between Krishna's habits of highly effective people and mundane effectiveness. We have to see a goal beyond simply working in this world, but working with a divine goal. To understand that we're ultimately not of this world at all. We are spiritual living beings. Are there any other questions, please? No? All right then. So that's about an hour, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. All right, one thing, I have another announcement too. We do have famous Hare Krishna vegetarian food. This is the yoga of eating. How about that? It sounds more easy than the yoga of mind control, doesn't it? Yeah, just outside here. There'll be sanctified vegetarian snacks, or is it more than snacks?
Yeah.
Okay, it's more than snacks. Complimentary.
You cook for 4 hours, three devotees.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, you really put a lot of love into it. It's the love that makes it great. So, yeah. And you want to announce afterwards about the books also, yeah. All right, go ahead. Thank you very much for coming. I understand all of you are busy people, motivated people, and I pray that you all got some benefit from this talk. We have, you're going to announce about the books afterwards. We have complimentary books also. So go ahead. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.